agreements with the U.S. to accept deportees from other countries. This is the president of Ghana, John Dramani Mahama, speaking earlier this month.
We were approached by the U.S. to accept third-party nationals who were being removed from the U.S. And we agreed with them that West African nationals, you know, were acceptable because all our fellow West Africans don't need a visa to come to our country. So if they decided to travel from U.S. to Accra, they don't need a visa anyway. So if you're bringing our colleague West Africans back, I mean, that's okay. And so I think that agreement has been activated, and a first batch of 14 nationals came.
But it appears the deportees did not stay in Ghana for long. Upon arrival, they were detained, and within days, it appears Ghanaian officials began repatriating the men to their home countries, exactly where they feared going. In the lawsuit filed by Asian Americans Advancing Justice and joined by the ACLU, attorneys assert the U.S. sent the men to Ghana with full knowledge they would then be sent to their home countries. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan said she was alarmed and dismayed at the men's removals and that they, quote, appear to be part of a pattern and widespread effort to evade the government's legal obligations by doing indirectly what it cannot do directly. Unquote. But she said her hands are tied. For more, we're joined by Lee Gelernt, Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, also adjunct professor at Columbia Law School, on the team representing some of the people sent to Ghana. In recent weeks, Lee won a major case in which one of the most conservative, if not the most conservative, federal appeals court panel in the country ruled President Trump cannot use the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to speed the deportations of people his administration accuses of membership in a Venezuelan gang. Lee, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about this case of the men being sent to Ghana with the U.S. fully knowing that Ghana will then send them exactly where they fear, where they fled from, their home countries.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. And you've described it perfectly. I think, and unfortunately, this fits a pattern of the Trump administration trying to evade court orders. So what's happened is these individuals have gone to immigration court, and the immigration court has said, you can be removed from the United States, but you cannot be removed to your home country because it's more likely than not you'll be persecuted or tortured there. So the United States government knows they can't send these individuals to their home country. They're prohibited by an immigration court from doing so. So what we think they're doing is finding third countries, and Ghana may just be the tip of the iceberg, sending them to the third country like Ghana, knowing full well, and we actually think directing the third country, in this case Ghana, to send them on to their home countries. So it's a complete ruse to get around the order from the immigration judge. The United States government, at a minimum, knows very well that the third country is going to send them on to persecution or torture. And again, we think probably directing them. And as you said, Judge Chutkan felt her hands were tied because they were already on the move. So what that suggests is that we're going to need to potentially bring a lawsuit for people still in the United States to stop the policy prospectively. So we are trying to get our hands around exactly what's going on. Obviously, the United States government is not playing this out in public, so we're going to have to do some digging. But it's becoming more and more clear that this is the United States government's way of sending people to persecution and torture, using these third countries to shield what they're doing.
So, Lee, could you explain how these third country agreements came about in the first place? Was there anything like this prior to the Trump administration or in his previous one?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So there's always been what's called diplomatic assurances, but they've been used very sparingly and only on an individual basis. So there are times when an individual can't be sent to their home country. The United States finds a third country to take them, but adopts a diplomatic assurance with that country that they will not be persecuted or tortured there. And because it was done so rarely and only with individuals, it could be monitored much more carefully. Are there safeguards in place to make sure this particular individual be safe in this third country. What the Trump administration has done now is said, we're going to do these categorically. We're going to get countries, we're going to pressure countries into taking as many people as we can send there and claim that they'll all be safe there. So we don't think that the individuals will all be safe in the third country. But what's happening now with Ghana is a whole nother chapter of this. Not only are they sending dozens and dozens of people to third countries under the claim that they'll be safe there, but now they're having these third countries send them on to countries where it's clear they won't be safe because an immigration judge has already found they won't be safe.
Let's turn to a declaration by a plaintiff who goes by the pseudonym KS out of concerns for his safety. He made the declaration while in hiding in the Gambia. The declaration reads in part, quote, on March 7, 2025, I won deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture from my home country of the Gambia due to the specific risks of torture and death I faced there on account of my sexuality. I spoke repeatedly with two Ghanaian immigration officials named Ibrahim Liang Hani and Ayaman. I explained to them my fear of returning to the Gambia, the basis of my fear, and the fact that I'd won protection from being returned to the Gambia under the Convention Against Torture. I told them I wanted to stay in Ghana for my safety. The official Ibrahim just told me that my final destination was the Gambia based on orders from ICE officials and his Ghanaian superiors. I'm now living in hiding in the Gambia with the help of my sister. I'm seeking a way out of the country as soon as possible for the sake of my life. Do you know KS?
Well, he's one of the plaintiffs in the case. I can't reveal, obviously, where he is or, I mean, specifically or exactly what's going on for safety. But I think his case is a prime example of what the United States is doing. So when we went before the judge, the government repeatedly said, well, we're sending people to Ghana, but they'll be safe there. And we pointed to KS and said, but you know KS now. We've told you Ghana has been sent on to the very country an immigration judge said he cannot be sent to because he's be in danger of torture there. And the United States government said, well, we have a diplomatic assurance with Ghana that that won't happen. And we said, but it has happened. And they kept saying, well, the court can't do anything. And so what I finally said out of an exasperation is, why aren't you concerned? You claim you have a diplomatic assurance with Ghana not to send people on to torture. If you really have that, why aren't you concerned? Why do you need a court order to call Ghana and say you're violating this diplomatic assurance? Well, of course, the Trump administration remained silent, didn't say anything. But the United States government should presumably be just as concerned as we are if Ghana is breaking the agreement. The truth is Ghana is not breaking the agreement. The truth is the United States has told Ghana to send these people on to their home countries.
Hmm. Lee, can you talk about the Trump administration trying to send Kilmar Abrego Garcia to Eswatini, formerly Swaziland? I mean, already having sent him to El Salvador to the mega prison, SECOT, then one of the lawyers admitting that they were wrong and they eventually brought him back, now deporting him to Africa, where he has no ties?
So this is a situation where the United States government is intent on putting him in a bad situation. Right? They admitted candidly, at least one lawyer who's now been fired has it candidly admitted it was a mistake. Rather than admitting that mistake, the Trump administration keeps doubling down and doubling down, and now is going to send him to a country she has no ties. But, you know, that his case has gotten a lot of publicity because of that mistake, but it's part of a pattern. We right now, the United States government is sending people all over the world to places they have absolutely no ties to. And so this is a remarkable break from prior administrations, both Democratic and Republican.
So let's go to Trump's words, in fact, talking about asylum seekers just earlier this week at the opening of the UN General Assembly.
When your prisons are filled with so-called asylum seekers who repaid kindness, and that's what they did, they repaid kindness with crime. It's time to end the failed experiment of open borders. You have to end it now. See, I can tell you. I'm really good at this stuff. Your countries are going to hell.
So that's Trump speaking earlier this week at the UN General Assembly opening in New York. So, Lee, your response to that, and of course what he said is not new. He's repeated it multiple times and also said that he's going after the worst of the worst.
Yeah. So two things about that. One is, I think when people said they wanted more immigration enforcement, they were voting for an abstraction, sort of a vague abstraction. Now that people are seeing what's happening in practice, I think you're seeing pushback, because it's very clear he's not just going after the worst of the worst. The administration is consistently seeking to arrest, detain, and deport people who have no crimes whatsoever. Families who have lived here for decades, who have paid taxes, are working, maybe their children are U.S. citizens. So that's absolutely clear, that notwithstanding the administration's constant refrain that they're only going after the worst of the worst, that's not true. But let me also talk about specifically asylum, because I think what's gone underreported is the fact that right in the beginning of the administration, he claimed that migrants were, quote unquote, invading the United States, and he ended all asylum. So people say to me, well, doesn't the border need some fixing? And we are all in favor of revision to border policy if it can be reasonable and have due process. What I don't think people understand is that the Trump administration has tried to eliminate all asylum by any means. So that means you come here, even if you present lawfully at a port, even if you have absolutely overwhelming evidence, you will be persecuted on account of your religion or your political opinion. There is no way in the United States any longer to apply for asylum. That puts us in a small handful of countries, Iran, North Korea, that don't have an asylum system. It's a remarkable turn of events for the United States. After we made the solemn promise after World War II, we would never send people back to danger without even a screening. People are constantly saying to me, well, didn't the border, you know, the asylum process need streamlining? Fine, but I don't think people realize there is zero pathway for people in danger now to apply for asylum in the United States. That's an extraordinary turn of events. We have challenged it. We won in court so far. The government has appealed. I suspect they could go to the Supreme Court. But people need to keep an eye on that, because it's simply not true that there's a way to apply for asylum any longer. You're in danger. The United States no longer gives you a safe haven, no matter how much danger you're in.
Lee Gelernt, Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, thank you so much for being with us. When we come back, we get an update on the Gaza-bound global Samud flotilla. But first to Yemen, where recent Israeli strikes on two newspaper offices killed 31 Yemeni journalists and media workers, making it the deadliest attack on journalists anywhere in the world in 16 years. Back in 20 seconds.
So.
Safu by Amadou and Mariam, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says recent Israeli strikes on two newspaper offices in Yemen killed 31 journalists and media support workers, making it the deadliest attack on journalists anywhere in the world in 16 years. An additional 22 journalists were also injured in the strikes. CPJ said the attack was the second deadliest attack on the press ever recorded by the organization. The Israeli attack on September 10th targeted a newspaper complex in Sana'a that housed several media outlets tied to the Houthi government, the Houthi movement. Israel and the Houthis have traded attacks since Israel launched its assault on the Gaza Strip in October 2023.
On Wednesday, the Houthis claimed responsibility for a drone attack on the southern Israeli city of Eilat. We go now to Niku Jafarnia, a researcher in the Middle East and North Africa Division for Human Rights Watch, investigating human rights abuses in Yemen and Bahrain. Thanks so much for being with us, Niku. Explain what happened, the day it happened, the buildings that were struck, most importantly, the fact that 31 journalists and their staff were killed.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. Yeah, on September 10th, along with several airstrikes that Israeli forces carried out in Yemen, they targeted what the Houthis describe as their Moral Guidance Directorate's headquarters, which houses a media complex in the center of Sana'a. We're talking about the very center of the city, which is incredibly packed with people. It's part of, it's right next to the old city of Sana'a, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And the strikes occurred in the evening, on a Wednesday evening, where it happened to be that one of the newspapers that's housed in this media complex was actually producing its paper for the next day. They produce a weekly paper that goes out every Thursday. And on this Wednesday evening, many journalists were inside of this media complex to produce the paper for the next day. And so when the attacks occurred, they ultimately killed, according to mainly Houthi-based sources, including one of the newspapers, 31 journalists. They also killed civilians who were walking on the street at the time, and one child was also killed in the attack. And we're talking, again, about, these are civilians. Civilians have been killed in numerous Israeli attacks on Yemen, and this is just yet another situation in which Israeli forces are killing journalists, as they've already done in Gaza, as they've done in Lebanon, in a new territory, and thus far have not received the international condemnation that they should be.
So, Niku, could you explain what Human Rights Watch is calling for, an arms embargo on Israel, and if you could elaborate?
Yeah, we've been from the very start of hostilities calling for an arms embargo from countries that are continuing to support Israeli forces. We have documented, like many other organizations, war crime after war crime after war crime, as well as acts of genocide and extermination in the context of Gaza. We've documented war crimes in Lebanon. We've documented war crimes in Yemen and in Iran, all committed by Israeli forces. And yet we are continuing to see, as Western states, particularly the United States, continue to provide support, not only financially, but also through weapons that are then being used in these attacks. We have found, remnants of U.S. guidance munitions in attacks that have been carried out that we've deemed to be war crimes in the context of Lebanon. And yet we, regardless of all this documentation, again, not just from Human Rights Watch, but from organizations and investigators all across the world, we see that these governments are continuing to support Israel, and even those that have made some statements across Europe condemning Israel's actions, they still are continuing to support them behind the scenes. And so we have been calling for an arms embargo.
Niku, could you put these attacks in the context of what Human Rights Watch has documented in Yemen, namely the increasing pressure and indeed also attacks on journalists in Yemen by Houthis and the government?
Yeah, I think what's honestly one of the most devastating aspects of this attack is that journalists in Yemen are already facing abuses from domestic authorities there. And that's been true for there's been, more than 11 years of conflict at this point in Yemen. And parties on all sides, in particular the Houthis, the Southern Transitional Council, which is backed by the UAE, and the Yemeni government have all carried out widespread abuses against journalists. We actually just released a report last week documenting a lot of these abuses, describing the ways in which these groups have arbitrarily detained, forcibly disappeared, tortured so many journalists over the last 11 years. They've also shut down media institutions and in some cases even killed journalists and detained social media influencers just for posting something on social media. So again, already journalists have been facing extremely dire conditions in the context of Yemen, and now they're also facing attacks by Israeli forces that are targeting them.
Niku Jafarneh, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Human Rights Watch researcher in the Middle East and North Africa. We're going to link to your report titled Israeli Forces Attack on Sana'a Kills Journalists, Israel, Yemen Authorities Targeting Media Workers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Spain and Italy are sending naval vessels to protect the Gaza-bound Global Sumud Flotilla after activists said that drones repeatedly attacked their boats near Greece on Wednesday. In a statement, the flotilla organizers said, quote, multiple drones, unidentified objects dropped, communications jammed, and explosions heard from a number of boats. Activists also said the strikes on Wednesday marked the seventh attack on the flotilla. The Global Sumud Flotilla set sail after Israel blocked two earlier attempts by activists to reach Gaza by sea.
Passengers aboard the flotilla, there are many boats, include the Swedish activist Greta Thunberg and Nelson Mandela's grandson, the South African MP Mandla Mandela. We're going now to the flotilla to speak with David Adler, the co-general coordinator of the Progressive International. He has a new piece in The Guardian headlined, We Are Sailing to Gaza, Here's Why. David, we see your hair blowing. We see you're on the ship. Can you explain what has taken place for people who haven't followed this flotilla? What is it and the significance of Italy and Spain sending their naval ships to protect you?
This Global Sumud Flotilla is the largest humanitarian convoy in history to traverse the Mediterranean Sea from Barcelona to Tunis to Sicily to here in Crete and onward to Gaza with a mission that's very simple but very urgent, which is to break the siege and to establish a permanent humanitarian corridor at sea to deliver critical aid to the starving people of Palestine. It is not an exaggeration, Amy, to say that this unprecedented mission, whose vessels number greater than the sum of all previous efforts from 2008 forward of Freedom Flotilla and its affiliates to try to reach Gaza, has faced bureaucratic sabotage, has suffered from drone attacks in the port of Tunis when we were on the boats and we were attacked with incendiary devices. But most terrifyingly, just here at sea before we entered near to Crete was two nights ago when for several hours, there were a bombardment. I mean, you have to imagine under the cover of darkness. We can't see these drones. We can hear them, but there's no lights on them. And all we can hear are the sounds of explosions. All we have is CCTV footage of the bombs being dropped onto the boats with an obvious intent to damage beyond repair these sailboats and therefore to deter the mission from going forward. In many cases, that was successful. Some of the boats were damaged on repair, and others were able to repair them. I think there's one little detail that your listeners and your viewers might be interested in, which is as they're deploying this illegal, deeply criminal act of violence against a civilian humanitarian mission like ours, they also jammed our communication channels with what? With ABBA, with Let's Lay Your Love on Me, which, of course, is a reference, a not-so-subtle reference, to the Swedish activist aboard Greta Thunberg, as you mentioned in the introduction to the segment, Amy. So it is in the wake of those really terrifying attacks that kept us up all night and put our lives at risk that we put out a message to the world, in particular a message to the governments of the Mediterranean, not just to send a declaration instead of or in recognition of our diplomatic or humanitarian ambitions, to join us, to send boats that can not just protect our lives, but can ensure the success of our mission. Which is an infrastructural one, is to set up a new corridor to reach the people of Gaza when the points on land have been so famously, so infamously blocked from access.
How many boats are there, David?
Right now, we're about 40 boats that have joined together from the three fleets, Barcelona, Tunis, or the Maghreb fleet, and the Italian fleet, and we're meeting six more boats that are now coming from Greece. We should be between 40 and 50 boats. Again, an unprecedented number of humanitarian vessels that is now setting sail on the final leg to reach the shores of Gaza.
David, you're breaking up a little, so we're going to fix that sound. And while we do, we're going to go to who you just referenced, the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. This is Greta speaking when the flotilla stopped in Tunisia.
The messages we have to Palestinians in Gaza are many. First, that I'm absolutely disgusted and appalled to live in a world where our people in power every day are betraying Palestinians, and how there are so many people who can seemingly just accept the extreme injustice and the mass slaughtering of people without doing anything. So for that, I am heartbroken. And this is not about me or my feelings at all, but I'm heartbroken to live in that world. What is happening now, for example, in Gaza City should not come as a surprise, because Israel have been very clear from the beginning that this is their intent. They have genocidal intent, that they want to take over the Gaza Strip, which is such a serious war crime. The world has not listened. Right now, people are more and more waking up, but at what cost? What is happening is, of course, an attack on Palestinians, the Palestinian identity, and the Palestinian nation, and all the countless of people whose suffering is being reduced to numbers and UN resolutions. This is also an attack on humanity, on international law, on every sense of humanity we have left. And that is a huge, huge risk. Of course, all right, risk is not the right word. It is a threat to everything we hold dear. What we are claiming to do is to act in line with international law. We are hearing the calls from Palestinians who are urging the people of the world to step up, to end our complicity, and we are doing a very small part of that, the bare minimum, to act, to uphold international law, human rights. Any risk we could be subjected to is, of course, nothing to what Palestinians are risking every day, just trying to survive. For example, the extremely brave Palestinian journalists who we are all in debt for them reporting about what is happening on the ground. They risk their lives every single day to tell the story. And the biggest risk is how we have allowed fascism and racism to escalate to such an extent that history keeps repeating itself.
So that's the climate activist Greta Thunberg. She's one of many activists on board some 40 ships in the Samud flotilla that have hit by drones. DropSite News is reporting Trump envoy Tom Barrack admits Israel bombed the global Samud flotilla ships in Tunisia earlier this month. That's where Greta was speaking. We're talking to live on the ship David Adler, co-general coordinator of the Progressive International.
So, David Adler, just before we finish, if you could say, what exactly are you carrying on the ship to Gaza, and what are you calling for now?
We are carrying these ships. Some of them are humble motor cruisers, like the family boat where I'm stationed, the lead vessel of the broader fleet. Some of them are even humbler sailing boats, are packed to the gills with basic and critical humanitarian aid, baby formula, medicine, food, and water. However, we're not naive about the scale of the suffering in Gaza and the scale of the humanitarian crisis that requires a much larger and more ambitious response by the states, whose good faith obligations under international law require them to respond under the Genocide Convention. So that's why I put so much emphasis on this infrastructural element of our mission. We are not here to drop the aid and go home and pat ourselves on the back.
We have 5 seconds,
David. We are here,
David,
to establish a humanitarian corridor for states themselves to assume their responsibilities and to deliver the aid at the scale that Gaza requires.
David Adler, co-general coordinator of Progressive International, one of the people on board the Samud flotilla headed to break the siege in Gaza. Spanish and Italian naval ships have gone to protect them. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Anya dreams of becoming the world's greatest chef. Max and Maria dream of skating for gold. Alex dreams of a life free of needles and pain beyond the walls of a hospital room. Right now in Canada, more than 10,000 children are being treated for cancer, and one in five will not survive. When you support Childhood Cancer Canada, you help fund critical research and provide financial assistance to families in their fight. Give life to dreams beyond kids' cancer at livefordreams.ca.